You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. And on our last show before Christmas, I thought that I wanted to do something maybe about Christmas or maybe about faith. And then I picked up a book that I'd had sitting around for a while by a local author here in Santa Fe, and I started reading it, and I was so drawn in that I read the whole thing at one sitting. And I think what I'm going to do is not say anything further about it in this introduction. I'm just going to go straight into the interview. I'd like to welcome Leona Stuckey. She's a psychotherapist, and she's the author of a book, The Fog of Faith, Surviving My Impotent God. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm very pleased to be here.
It's great to have you here, and I had this experience. You had let me know quite a while ago about your book, and recently I just said, oh, you know, I've never read that. Let me just read page one. Well, several hours later, I got to the end, barely having breathed. It was such a riveting narrative about your life. It's a memoir of what you experienced first growing up on a farm in Kansas, where you came from a family of Mennonites. What was that like, both the farm and the religious piece?
Well, that's a big question, Mary Charlotte. And certainly it was hard work. Being a farmer in the old days of farming, where we didn't have a lot of the major kinds of equipment that people have now for major farming. We had animals of every type, and so there was different feeding and watering and daily taking care of, and it was just a nonstop, ever-present work relationship. And so much of it was fun, because our family would create, you know, we would laugh at whatever happened. You know, if somebody caught their hand in the gate, unless it was really seriously a problem, everybody laughed. And if somebody stubbed their toe or spilled something on themselves or whatever it was, we made it fun. And I think that came from mom and dad originally, but us kids did it all the time too.
And you were one of many girls. There were seven children and the last one was a son, but basically you ended up being kind of the, almost like the boy, the farmhand, mm-hmm. who did so many different tasks and kind of with your dad more than any of the other kids.
I did. I was the second oldest, and the oldest was more of a in-the-house kind of person. And I early on started helping my dad, and I so enjoyed being with him. He had kind of a peaceful countenance that made it very pleasant to be with him. And I loved going outside. All the action for me was outside. And I think when I was like so too young to really go out much, I would look out the window and long for those days that I would have outside. So yes, I had a lot of time with him. And there wasn't a boy then. So it really, I was the boy, so to speak.
And your family were Mennonites. Tell us what it meant to you and kind of more the general, like what does it mean to grow up Mennonite?
We were what is called General Conference Mennonites. And there's a pretty big difference between rural and urban Mennonites. General Conference tends to be the least restrictive Mennonites. So if you were driving by our farm and you just looked at it, it would not look different than other farms. You would have to really get to know us to know what Mennonite meant to us. Because, you know, we had cars, we had electricity, we had those things. Although as girls, we weren't supposed to wear, you know, anything flashy. And we were supposed to be especially modest. And there was a lot of emphasis on family integrity and everybody being good to each other. Probably the two biggest areas where Mennonites tended to differ from other Christians was Mennonites are what's called a peace church. And that meant, in my family at least, that there would be no physical violence. So it would not be appropriate for us to strike another person. It would not be appropriate, although we did violate that as children sometimes, it would not be appropriate for mom and dad, if somebody came to hurt us on the farm, for them to fight that person in a physical way, certainly in a verbal way, but not in a physical way. And so we kind of knew, you know, we felt totally safe because we were in the country and, you know, nothing bad ever happened. And we were all around other Mennonites primarily. So everybody was nonviolent in our world. But that was a very prominent theme. And it was so prominent that I think, unlike even other people who were, other communities that tended to be nonviolent, we more went with, choose the person that wrote War and Peace, Tolstoy. Anyway, we followed that principle, which was that the state did not have a right to put people in positions where they would have to commit violence or experience violence. So we were anti-war in our nonviolent stance, just as Tolstoy was anti-war.
And your father went to jail for refusing to serve in the military.
Correct. Yeah. He came of age at the time of World War II. And of course, that was a very popular war. And people made judgments about anybody who refused to go. And so it was quite a cross to bear, I guess, to say no and then to go to prison.
So for all the conversation about how you were safe in the countryside and it was a community where everybody knew each other, when you were a teenager, you met a boy, started a relationship. He worked on the farm with you and your dad. But then you realized that there was something off. You didn't want to be with him. And even before you told him that, he intuited it and began to violently terrorize you.
Yes, yes. And there was one night when I had planned to tell him. I had planned several times to tell him, and it was really hard. One night, his eyes rolled up into his head. I mean, it was just the weirdest thing. I'd never experienced anything like that. And so I took care of him and then drove him home the next day. And his parents took him to the doctor. And it wasn't long after that, I think that was an expression of the amount of stress that he was in about, you know, me potentially leaving him. And I think he just emotionally could not handle that. And so he became brutally violent with me when he thought I was leaving him. And he threatened, and, you know, I'm not going to go into everything that he did. It's in the book.
But, well, I think we can say on the program, rape and threat of murder, and mm-hmm. threat of brutal murder mm-hmm. explicitly mm-hmm. Narrated in a way that was mm-hmm. so scary for anybody. I can't even imagine this sort of innocent 16-year-old girl mm-hmm. having to encounter this. And yet you had and continued to have throughout your life, throughout the book, certainly, an incredible instinct for survival.
Mm. You know, you do what you have to do. I feel like that's what I did. I just did what I had to do. The hardest part was that he had threatened, and I, after that night, I believed his threat that he would kill my family if I left him. He would kill me, of course, but also my family. And my family was completely vulnerable. And so I felt like I had absolutely no choice. So I had to stay with him. You know, the first time that I had to, you know, about a week or two after my devastating night, I had to go back on a date with him. And then that carried on and on and on. And I kept praying for help because I knew nobody else could help me, but I thought God really could, and that this would really be God's easiest challenge because all it took was a little influence. You know, all he had to do was influence Ron to not ever come to my house again, for him to develop a new relationship with somebody else, for him to, you know, do anything other than pursue me.
And God did not comply, which led to a crisis of faith for you.
Correct. A couple of years down the road, I finally gave up.
Meanwhile, it's such an irony or such a difficult situation that there you were in this Mennonite household where almost anybody else's dad probably would have had at least one shotgun and defended mm-hmm. the living heck out of you, but it was your dad's way to try to go have a talk with this person, mm-hmm. which didn't work. The police who were charged with helping you didn't help. His parents didn't even believe you. I mean, it wasn't like mm-hmm. you even hid what happened. You told everybody what happened. Mm-hmm. It's so striking how unprotected you were.
Mm-hmm. I love the Me Too campaign because finally women are believed. You know, they're being taken a little more seriously. But at that time, the shame was massive. And it was all about women being blamed. You know, if you were raped or if you were pregnant or if you were, you know, had sex before marriage, if you were seen as a slut, and it was all about how bad you are as a little Christian girl that you didn't follow your beliefs, and shame was deeply, deeply apparent from the moment in which it happened.
And meanwhile, they don't seem to have any problems with a violent rapist who's terrorizing teenage girls.
Right.
We know this happens, and somehow, because I know you a little mm-hmm. bit and am reading this book and you don't have anything to prove, you know?
Right.
The reality of it sunk in for me in a new way. You ended up basically forced to marry this man.
Because I was, yes.
He required sex of you. You got pregnant. What happened then?
Well, then I had to confess in front of my little country church where everybody was a relative or, you know, had some close connection to me. It was a little rural church. It was like a half a mile from my house. If I crossed the pasture, I would be right at the church. And I'd been there my entire life. This community knew me. They knew my parents. They knew my grandparents and my great-grandparents. And on both sides of my family and in front of them, I had to confess that I had gotten pregnant, that I had not followed God's way, that I was sinful and had no right to expect mercy except that our God was merciful and loving.
Then you ended up essentially mother and hostage in your own home.
That's correct. Yes. I tried to learn how. I was too young to understand really, and this hurts me to this day, that I wasn't a better mother. But the situation was horrific. And I had to somehow take care of a baby.
What were your days like?
You know, I had to stay in the house unless Ron had given me permission to go outside. So most days I was just in the house. But Ron would give me permission to go outside if I had to go to the bank or I had to go get some groceries. And then I didn't have a car, so it would be walking. And I would push my baby in a buggy. Or maybe I would be taking him to the doctor to get shots or something. So some days I would get to go out for walks that way. I always wondered if Ron had some setup that he could tell if I had left the house, because I knew that if he thought I was gonna leave, you know, if he thought I had found a way to get away or I was out there in the world figuring something out to get away, he would go crazy again, and I probably wouldn't survive that.
You eventually moved to Boston, Massachusetts, and you were able to escape. The violence escalated. You mm-hmm. followed a sibling out to the mm-hmm. East Coast, thinking maybe you would have more of a chance there, which you did. What led you to make that escape? How did you do it? What kind of systems were in place to help you?
I made the escape by hearing on the radio. I was a maid and babysitter, and we lived above the garage, so we had our rent free. So I would go to work a little bit later than Ron would go to work, and in that time, I heard a message on the radio about, if you're having family troubles, call this number. And so I called that number, and they said they would make an appointment for me and that I needed to get there. Well, the only way I could get there was to have siphoned off a little bit of change from Ron's pockets when I did the laundry or had any extra money anywhere, which was always very tight. And I hid it under the carpet. And I knew if Ron found that money that I would be dead, because he would know I was trying to leave. But I had enough money to take a cab. And I made the arrangement for a time when I knew Ron would be gone. And so I went to that appointment. And luckily, I sat with a therapist who was magnificent. And she understood right away the danger that I was in. And she said, Leona, you will die if you don't get out of there really soon. You will die. So I had told my dad that I thought I just had to leave because I was so afraid that Ron would do something to my family. And he said, Leona, go and I'll handle it. I'll do the best I can. And I knew that I would die and my son would have no one if I didn't get out. So this social worker said she would come and get me. Oh my God, that was absolutely amazing that she would do that. And so I got out because she got me and she helped me get on welfare. And she took me to, they didn't have any women's shelters then, but she took me to another woman's home who was also on welfare. and had, this a woman had three children and a larger home. And so she had one room she could rent to me, and that's all I could afford on welfare was this one room. But we became, you know, fast friends, and it worked out in a very nice way.
The social worker and the fact that there was enough of a welfare system that you were able to survive and move mm-hmm. on. And you had this idea deep inside of you that you wanted to go to college.
Right.
And you managed to do it.
I was so fortunate. That was something I had my heart and soul set on, that somehow I was going to make it to college.
And you did, and you went to Boston College, but meanwhile, this horrible, horrible man, I can barely use the word husband to describe him, because mm-hmm. it was more of a hostage situation than a marriage, but he continued to, and I don't know how he did it, you don't describe it in the book, but he continued, no matter how well you hid, to find you and terrorize mm-hmm. you and kidnap you, and you continued to use the most ingenious ways to escape and not be killed. Mm-hmm. One of them was you spent the entire night telling a story to him that you thought he would believe.
I did. I knew that was my only way to get away. And so I told him a story about how I would come back to him and he and I could live together happily ever after. And I built all the details of how we would live that would work for his lifestyle, and just built it up until he believed me. And I lasted until I stayed awake for 24 hours. And he was so exhausted that he let me go to pick up my son. And I told him I'd come right back. And he just went to sleep.
Meanwhile, of course, you called the police, and mm-hmm. that resulted in, you know, incarceration that didn't last very long, hospitalization that didn't last very long, mm-hmm. and a continual series of incidents in which you were not protected.
Correct. It was unbelievable to me even then.
We're talking Boston in the 1970s.
Right. And women were not believed. People didn't care. The police were more interested in harassing me, because here I am, this quote-unquote welfare bitch who was troubling them, and so they wanted to get me in trouble. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was astonished. There was just no way to get protection. I went to the district attorney. The things that Ron did weren't covered in the law, because the law saw me still as his wife, and therefore he had rights over me, even the right to rape me. And so the law couldn't really protect me. And we had to look for all kinds of things to try to get some protection. It was not at all effective.
Somebody gave you the name of a man who was a wealthy kind of upscale attorney who you thought might be able to help you.
Correct. And yeah, I didn't even know what pro bono was, but the person said, you know, he'll take the case pro bono because he has all this money and he's in a wealthy attorney's office. But he didn't forgive the payment that I wouldn't be able to make. He propositioned me to basically become a prostitute on the yacht that his company had, and to work with them on weekends, and said how I would be happy and there were plenty of drugs and everybody there had a great time over the weekends, and you know, and probably all they'd have to do is make a call, because their office was so prestigious, they could make a call and keep Ron in the hospital. That's what I was trying to do, is get some help so that Ron would have to stay in the hospital.
For the criminally insane.
For the criminally insane, so I would not have to fear him anymore, and he couldn't do anything to my family. So they could have made one phone call.
But instead, they asked you or said, if you want this done, you're going to have to be my prostitute.
Absolutely.
And you said no.
And I said no. I said, please help me. I'm not comfortable with your proposal. And I said no, partly because my only time with my son was on the weekend. I was at Boston College then. I never had enough time for studies and everything else that I had to do. If I had done their stint on the boat, on the yacht, I would have had no time with my son. And I would have felt like I had violated the last bit of Mennonite in me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was just so far from who I was and what my world was.
And yet you were balancing prostitute on a yacht versus rape and murder.
Yeah.
Versus being the... And the other thing I want to ask you was, I mean, your son, at a very young age, saw a lot of violence. How mm-hmm. did it affect him at the time, in the future? How did you deal with that?
It was really tough, and I made plenty of mistakes along the way because I was so young and I didn't understand everything. But I was compassionate, thank goodness that was in my nature. And so I just tried to understand what he was going through and worked with him to help him not act out. Of course, I think he just needed to act out. That was, you know, he just didn't understand this world, and we had to keep moving in order to try to hide. And so his world was disrupted over and over again. But, you know, I'd read him stories and hold him at night and play with him and do whatever I could to help him with this craziness in our lives.
Meanwhile, you had what, I don't know if they'd coined the term PTSD, post-traumatic stress, at that time, but you must have been walking around with that. And I was reading the book going, how well would I have survived in her situation? The fact that you were able to not only be a mother, but to go to college, get good grades, and be engaged in your studies is almost inconceivable. Like, how did you do that?
You know, probably if I had to do it today, I certainly couldn't have. But I was so thrilled to be in college. I felt like I had this tremendous blessing and that it was my way to turn around my life. And by gosh, I was going to do it. I just was going to do it. I felt like I owed that to me and to my son. And I am intellectually curious as a person. So to be able to go to class and learn things was fascinating to me. I remember people would say at college, they'd comment on how much I smiled. And I thought, that's so weird because I feel like I'm under pressure and I feel like I'm hardly ever smiling. But, you know, I loved it. I loved it.
You were talking earlier about how you, as a kid, had this upbringing where, unless you did something that was like a really dire accident where you had to go to the hospital, everybody just kind of laughed it off. And so you were
right.
Kind of like stoic and tough mm-hmm. farm kids. Now you're a psychotherapist, and my understanding of psychotherapy is you're supposed to feel the pain and let it out, mm-hmm. which you guys didn't. And I thought to myself, you know, that upbringing stood you in good stead.
Mm-hmm.
Because
it did.
You didn't have to like break down and cry every few minutes. You were trained to keep moving.
We were totally trained to keep moving. And I also think that because we were my poor mom and dad didn't really have other adults to talk to. They talked to each other, but they didn't have other adults. And so it was a very, in many ways, a quiet home. With seven kids, you can imagine there was chatter all the time. There was this and that. But my time with my dad was nonverbal primarily. We talked about the things we were doing or whatever, but it allowed me to read nonverbal cues. I often thought that was the very best training to become a psychotherapist, because our whole community did not talk much, really. You know, everybody talked about the price of wheat, but everybody was rather stoic. And when you live in a community where everybody knows everybody, it becomes imperative to keep your secrets to yourself. And so nobody talked much. So if you were going to understand what was really going on, you had to be able to read between the lines and see. And I think that helped me a lot, both in being able to escape Ron because I could understand what was going to come next, and also in terms of picking up on a lot of cues. When you face life and death danger, at least when I did, I felt like I experienced things acutely. So I paid a lot of attention that I probably wouldn't have paid to everything that happened. And when I saw the reality of Ron believing my story that time, I also realized how susceptible humanity is, including me, to a good story. I mean, to something that we think might help us, might be our answer, might give us what we need. We are highly susceptible.
Whether it's true or not.
Whether it's true or not. Exactly.
How did you, over the course of your life, I mean, the memoir ends when you're in your early 20s, I think. There's still more to talk about, but how have you gone about healing from what happened to you? Because, I mean, for most of the course of the book, you were in survival mode, escape mode, trying to get out, eventually finding a man whom you really did love. But I would imagine that after that, in your 30s and 40s, perhaps, you would have had to go into a pretty deep healing place.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I did, and this is probably true of many, many, many therapists, there's a book called On Becoming a Therapist. I read it in that time frame in my early 30s. And in that book, it says, it talks about the traumas that are typically there for people who become therapists. So in becoming a therapist, I was studying, and even at Boston College, I was studying psychology and philosophy. And so I was trying to understand, what does it mean to be human? And I have spent a lifetime trying to understand that. And we'll always be trying to understand that. It is a huge question. But it's not just how do I do this technique or do that technique that will, you know, help somebody become better or relieve pain. It's really grasping so much more. And looking at that helps one expand understanding and knowledge and appreciation of the struggle that it means for us to live each day as human beings.
When you look back on your story and particularly on the psychology of the man who was trying to terrorize you. What do you think was wrong with him? Why was this man who terrorized you the way he was? Do you have any insight about that after all this time?
I do. He wound up terrorizing my sister also after I wasn't able to keep him in the Institute for the Criminally Insane. And my sister spent also a lifetime working with people who she worked in shelters and spent a lifetime, both of us did, trying to understand what goes on with human beings. Why do we become the way we become? And her name is Dorothy, and she really did an analysis of men who would abuse. And while the common understanding is that those men are narcissistic, extremely narcissistic, and kind of broken in their narcissism, and so they feel entitled and they're going to do what they whatever they want to and expect women to serve them. And that's certainly part of it. But there's also men who are compelled because they are, I'm going to say, unable to feel like they are a full person on their own. So they are batterers who come out of that sense of being in a symbiotic relationship. So they feel like if somebody leaves them, that they in essence have died. They in essence have lost everything. And they can't withstand psychologically. They have a lot of difficulty withstanding that. So almost always with those, with that type of batterer, abuser, the woman really risks death when they leave, because he would rather kill her and kill himself, or kill her and get away, kill her and kill the kids, than be left. And the most dangerous time for a woman when she is getting away from a batterer is when he believes that she's not coming back. And sometimes that's immediately, but sometimes that's days or weeks or even months later. Or maybe he hears that she's no longer working on the relation. Who knows? But that's the time when it becomes really dangerous. And then there's a few, but there's relatively few batterers who are really sadistic. And their aim is to cause pain for another because that helps them feel pleasure. So they will actually hurt in the most sadistic ways people in order to get that pleasure for themselves. That's really unhinged in many ways. Ron was this kind that was fused and didn't feel like he could be a whole person without having that one symbiotic relationship. That is a huge part of what unhinged him. But there was another part, and that is after I left him, I think he was under so much stress then that he did have a psychotic break. And even though he had all, you know, lots of symptoms ahead of time, he was very paranoid, he was very controlling. Certainly he had threatened everything and beaten me and those kinds of things, but he didn't talk crazy, if you know what I mean. I mean, it seemed like he was still relatively connected to reality. But afterwards, the paranoid schizophrenic part really came to play. His brain parted company with reality, shall we say. And so that became an issue that was never really healed for him.
And he's still alive.
Yes.
But you feel safe.
I do. I mean, now it's so easy to find me. For so many years, I hid. But I think he just isn't up to par enough to really find me, and hasn't been for a number of years now. But he tracked for about 30 years.
How did your discovery of feminism affect you and affect your path in life?
Oh, my goodness. That was such an amazing revelation to me. And to this day, I feel so grateful to those early feminists. I mean, I feel like I was an early feminist, but those who even came before me that started talking about feminism and started raising the issue, and I started hearing about it when I was at Boston College. And it was like such a revelation to me. I had no idea that women could be thought of as equally important to men. You know, TV was all about men. Sitcoms were about men primarily. The news was all delivered by men. Men ran the world. Men were everything. And men were important and women weren't. And it was just clear from day one that we were secondary after all. Jesus didn't call us to be his disciples, so clearly we weren't supposed to have importance, you know, be the important decision makers and be out there in the world. And women were just marginalized entirely. I lived in a very patriarchal world and very biblically patriarchal. So to have the thought, just the thought, that it might be possible that women could be equally important in the world as men are, was revolutionary to me.
How did all of this affect your faith? I thought it was fascinating that you lost your faith when you realized that God, nor anybody else, was really going to help you, but especially God, just wasn't going to intervene. Then you met, when you were in your early 20s, a man whom you married, who really loved you and whom you loved. He was in training to be a minister, and then you went to seminary, and I was reading, I was like, what?
Yeah. Talk about your history following you. You know, my history was pretty darn strong, I have to say.
Well, there's a striking moment in the book where you say the further you got away from belief, the closer you got to people who were believers.
Yes, yes. It was so interesting to me. You know, I took a very strong stand against belief. And when I went to Boston College, I didn't even realize that it was such a quote-unquote Christian Catholic institution. It was taught by the Jesuits, and I have tremendous respect for the Jesuits. And when I first went there, I said, I will not take a class from any priest because I don't want any more religion crammed down my throat. And so I didn't. But as I got into more of the philosophy, deeper psychology kinds of concerns, the students said, oh, you've got to take this priest, that priest, because they've been so incredibly well educated. They know this stuff better than anybody, and they're the best teachers. And so I kind of lessened my rigid rule and started taking classes, and they were the best teachers, and they were amazing people. And here I was feeling horrible for being on welfare, and I just got the sense that even if they knew I was on welfare, they would still respect me. that was so meaningful because their way of thinking aligned with mine. Not theologically, I was not going to accept anything about religion, but I couldn't deny the way in which our thinking worked and our sentiments and our social justice concerns.
And so that led you to, I mean, you're a psychotherapist now, but did you study to be a minister?
I did. I decided that I had to know. I had to know, is this a story that I buy into or that I did buy into? Is this a story that everybody buys into?
The God story.
The God story. Like Ron bought into my story? Or is there something about this that is real? And I decided that knowing that was the only thing that was going to release me to go on with my life.
And what did you come to?
Well, I came to another trauma that brought me to, I'm going to say, the brink. And so as I went to seminary, and that's kind of where the book ends, what I can say is that though I went to seminary, belief is not that simple. I don't think it's that simple for anybody. There's a part of us, and especially those of us who grew up steeped in Christianity, for example. I can speak more with authority about Christianity than any other religion, so I'm going to try to just say Christianity. Belief is from every fiber of our being. And we are not conscious of every fiber of our being. And our being is layered. Just like my identity is partly Mennonite, I will never be really not Mennonite. That's a huge part of who I am. And even though I may have years and years and years of living differently than a Mennonite would live, that's a deep part of who I am. And faith is very much that way. There is, as far as we know, and this is not, as far as I know, this isn't totally scientifically proven, but it makes a lot of sense, that there's kind of a bell curve about faith. And that is that maybe 10% of the population is a believer from childhood that has never had significant doubts. The belief is so synonymous with who they are and what their life experience is that they haven't had to have doubts. And then from that 10% comes up to this bell curve where we have about 50% doubt and 50% belief at the top of the bell curve. And then as we go over the bell curve, we come around to being kind of agnostic and maybe more and more atheistic, agnostic, and then maybe going into atheism. Now, I know that as science takes a stronger hold in our world, so does atheism. Scientists are primarily atheists. And when we honor the need to walk close to reality, what we know to be reality has a profound impact on what we're capable of believing with our conscious, rational mind. But that's not our only mind. So what we believe unconsciously, which is also a huge influence on who we are, and what we believe in the science or the evidenced part of who we are, may be opposing sides. And I think it's a mistake that we try to say, oh, I'm an atheist, or oh, I'm a Christian. We're probably not either. We most likely have very significant doubts and strong ways in which we don't believe, and strong ways in which we do. And we have the job, we being us as individuals, have the job of sorting that out. And we do that every day on our spiritual journeys. And most of us do have a spiritual journey, whether or not it's that we sit in church on Sundays and hear something that we maybe partially believe and partially don't, or fully believe or mostly don't believe, or, you know, it's across the board. We may have a Christian identity. We may say we believe in God. That doesn't mean that we do. What it often means, and Daniel Dennett does a very good job of describing this, he talks about how there are people who say they are believers because they believe that belief is good. And then there are people who actually believe in God. And that many times we don't do that hard work of deciphering what's real in there. We just kind of stay fuzzy, which is part of the fog of faith.
Which is the name of my book.
Right.
This book to me illustrated very graphically the way in which things have changed since you were a young woman who was unprotected by the systems that were supposed to protect you, and also illustrates, sort of reminds us of how far we still have to go. Mm-hmm. There are rape crisis centers now that didn't exist then. There are battered women's shelters and family shelters. There's all kinds of psychotherapy that maybe didn't exist then. There's, at least sometimes in some places, police that have been trained to understand what's going on. The laws have changed. There are laws that weren't there before. At the same time, this Me Too movement is bringing out so clearly how much we as women have still felt we needed to stay silent about until now. What's your perspective on this?
Well, I am so pleased about the Me Too movement. I think it's absolutely wonderful that women are now speaking up, because so much of us have carried shame for whatever reason. And you hear it in almost every woman that speaks up. You hear that, you know, well, I was ashamed. I thought I had done something, or thank goodness now I hear that this person is a serial abuser or rapist or whatever, because it starts to alleviate some of the shame. Or when we understand that shame is a cultural force that is used to oppress us, when we understand that, we start to get our voices. And then we can start to feel some of the real power that is within us. And women have been held down by the force of shame in ways that we have no idea. And once we get through that shame, and I'm hoping that Me Too will really help people let go of it, because shame is brought on by culture and religion as a way of controlling women, of keeping us marginalized. And we have to oppose every ounce of religion that shames us and every ounce of culture that shames us, even more than the quote-unquote men that abuse us. And I hope we will realize that in the Me Too movement, that the men that abuse us are acting out what they know as their right because they've been entitled by culture and religion, religion as an arm of culture in this case, and a very powerful arm, the more powerful arm in this case. So Me Too, because almost every woman, you know, I can't say every woman, but many, many, many women, I would say the vast majority of us have a Me Too claim. We understand.
Whether it be as severe as what you've gone through, right, or as relatively mild as what many of the rest of us have gone through.
Right. But we know that power differential. We know at least some of what the old history of privilege means for men versus women. It's definitely not the same way that it was, thank goodness. But if women's voice can get out there, and if women can be truly empowered, things that have happened, like the way in which this last election put an abuser of women in power, that could never happen. It could not happen if women start to really hear themselves and take themselves seriously and not just take the party that they belong to as their source of belonging, and so they're willing to deny what they know as a woman.
Leona Stuckey is a psychotherapist. Her book is called The Fog of Faith, Surviving My Impotent God. Thank you so much for being with us.
Mary Charlotte, it was such a joy to be with you, and thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you.
If you would like to find out more about the book, you can go to the website thefogoffaith.com. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.